I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey guys, it's Candace
and Kayla, and we are directionally challenged.
Yep, we were supposed to have everything figured out by this point in our life.
But guess what? Surprise, we don't.
We don't. Luckily, tons of us do not have it all figured out. And guess what? It's totally okay. But we have a guest today who we think has a lot of stuff figured out. You've heard her name mentioned on this podcast so many times.
Julie Plack.
The epic Julie Plack is with us today.
We are so excited. We've wanted her as a guest from the start, and we just admire so much who she is as a woman and everything she represents. And we think that you guys will absolutely love this conversation we're having with her.
We are humbled to be able to call her a friend at this point. She was the creator, executive producer of Vampire Diaries, writer, directed many episodes. She now also, and then also had the originals.
The spinoff of the originals.
She's now got Legacies out.
Yeah.
She's an executive producer on Roswell, New Mexico.
I mean, the list could go on forever, you guys. And I know she has so many stories to go along with all of it. So without further ado, we want you guys to hear this awesome interview with the infamous Julie Plack. Guys, we are here with one of our absolute, do I say all-time favorite guests? We haven't even had the interview yet, and we love her so much.
Epic guest.
Julie Plack, we are so excited you're here.
I am so happy to be here. By the way, like, I started, you know, listening to your guys' podcast when you first launched, and I thought, oh, that's nice. Like, you know, it's all about like not knowing where you're going to be when you're 30. I'm like, so they're never going to invite me on and I'm never going to be able to come and do this because I'm past 30. So I'm really happy that you guys have like expanded your
part of it is
statement.
Also bringing people on that we admire. So we want to try and emulate. And I think that's a position you fit more so than someone who's directionally challenged because we're sitting in your gorgeous house. You definitely have your life together. I can tell you that much.
Oh, if only.
You were definitely on our short list right when we started.
Oh, of course.
Julie's gotta come on. Mm-hmm. We were hoping.
Well, I'm proud to be here. And amazing. I've been listening to everything and I love it. And you guys are doing a great job already.
So. Well, you're doing a great job juggling all these hats. Executive producer, writer, showrunner, director.
I know.
Can you believe it? I know. Did you think you'd be directing at this point? Did you ever want to be a director?
No, never. Mm. I mean, the story and I've told it a lot, and so I'll try to keep it brief. But the story I always tell is that there were two things when I moved to Hollywood that I knew fundamentally I would never do. One was writing and one was directing. And the reason was, scarred from college, I had taken a playwriting class in college. It was the only writing class I ever took. And I hated it so much. And I wrote like this crap play overnight. When it was due, like everybody had been working on their play all quarter. And I think I wrote it in about 36 hours. And the teacher just looked at me and kind of like shook his head in disapproval. And I think I got like a C or a C minus, which may have been the lowest grade I ever got in my entire life. I got in playwriting at Northwestern. And then I also directed a musical in Northwestern, which I had waited my whole like 4 years to be able to do because I was a stage manager and behind the scenes and running crew and a producer. And all I wanted to do was direct. And I was so bad at it, like bad at it, in a way that scarred me so much that I thought, well, I will never do those two things again. And what I did realize when I did direct the musical that I was really good at producing. And so I just figured that was my path. And lo and behold, the two things that scared me the most and that basically I sucked at the most ended up being the two things that I fell into later in my career and have now just kind of absorbed and now that's just what I am.
Oh, that's so great. I want to go on that journey with you. So you start at when did you first think that you would had stories to tell?
Okay, so I never thought I really had stories to tell. And yet when I really looked back at it, realized I'd been telling stories my whole life. And so because of the playwriting class, I'd always been a creative writer. And like mostly, really my journey is this. When I was in third grade, I entered the Young Author Contest by writing a little story and I won. And then also in third grade, I was bored. And so I wrote like Cinderella, the play, on mimeograph paper and directed the kindergartners. But somehow those two things and then all the little short stories and stuff I wrote as a kid never occurred to me that I was a creative writer or that I was a storyteller in any way. I just was like looking for something fun to do. And then, as I got into college, high school and college, every time there was a paper due, I would first panic, procrastinate, panic, cry, hyperventilate, die a little, and then write it really quickly the night before it was due. And I would always get A's, which was a nice, terrible. I would never recommend it to anybody because the emotional experience was so awful.
Only you can procrastinate and get A's.
I could always get A's. What? And but what happened was is that because I didn't really have time or the brain power to do a lot of research, as a way of getting through the paper, I would take like a creative angle on it and make it my almost like a creative writing assignment. So I would do something sort of kitschy or fun or cool and made the paper a really fun read. And so teachers and my professors, I think, were just so glamored by the fact that it wasn't a dry, boring paper that they didn't realize that I had kind of fucked off the work and hadn't really done the homework, you know, and were just thrilled that it wasn't boring. And so I skated my whole life by being creative. And yet I think because I hadn't, you know, because of the stupid playwriting class, I just felt like it wasn't a gift that I had and that I wasn't any good at it. And it wasn't until I was honestly in my 30s, I think, that enough people said, why aren't you writing? You should be writing, because I was working with writers. I was helping writers. I was ghostwriting for writers just as a way of like getting words on the page for them so that they could take it and make it better. And somebody's like, why aren't you a writer? And I said, because I'm bad at it. And then I sort of looked around and realized, well, wait a second. Actually, I've written words that have ended up on TV. I've written words that have ended up in a movie. I, you know, have been telling stories theoretically since I was a kid. I read a million books as a kid. So it just kind of happened. So I think I was my own worst critic, frankly. And I think that that's a thing that we do to ourselves. We just convince ourselves that like, if you're not perfect, if you're not extraordinary at something, that it's not worth pursuing. And we talk ourselves out of our own ambition sometimes.
And we let other people dictate what we are and what our abilities are by their judgment.
Yeah.
Like the fact that he said, oh, well, that wasn't a good enough paper. That's not a great writing piece. It's like, oh, well, I guess that's not my thing.
Yeah. And by the way, he was right. It was bad. But like, does that mean that I just am incapable of putting words on the page forever? Somehow in my head, that's what I define that as. And I was wrong. It probably took me another 10 years before I felt even remotely comfortable. Not even 15 years before, I was in my 30s for sure, before I felt comfortable saying, like, I think I can do this.
So is it Kevin Williamson who asked you if you are a writer? Or who
did you meet, Williamson or Wes first? That's what I was trying to figure
out. We're talking Kevin Williamson or Wes Craven.
Yes. Okay. So right, I moved out of college. I moved to California to pursue my dreams. And people always say, well, what did you want to do when you got here? And I said, I wanted to be around famous people. And that is the dumbest thing, but in its own way is completely true. Like, I've always been a little bit embarrassed by my aspirations and the way that it all began. Cause I just, you know, I grew up loving movies and TV and I just wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to be like a guest at the party, you know? And so I was lucky enough. I had one job that lasted not long and was over not soon enough. But I then was able to go work for Wes Craven as his assistant. Even though I didn't like horror movies and I didn't want to be a director, of course, let's remember, because I sucked at it, right? So I was just so glad to get out of the job I had before that, which lasted about 4 months. And then I met Kevin within that first year because he had written Scream. And he came in to meet with Wes and I said hello and shook his hand. And because I was an executive for Wes and then Kevin Williamson and then a couple other producers over my, you know, early career days, I met a lot of writers along the way and I would do a lot of work with those writers to help them shape their pitches or edit their scripts. And so many of those writers, one of whom was a friend of mine from college, who this small-time hack TV producer named Greg Berlanti.
That's crazy that you guys were friends from college.
I know. Yeah. By the way, the story I always tell is that Greg took that playwriting class before me, and he said that's the class that made him, taught him everything he knows about writing. And he still uses the like sort of story breaking format he learned in that class. And that changed his whole life for the better and made him realize just how much God-given talent he had that class. I was just like, well, I
that just goes to show that everyone works differently too. Yeah. Like you're both so successful in your own right, but what worked for him didn't resonate with you and vice versa.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it did. And I would be like, I just don't understand what this man is saying. But Greg was very supportive early on. Just he and I would, you know, sit together in our studio apartment down the hall from each other and order Chinese food and talk about the stories he wanted to tell. And I would help him, you know, just, I was a sounding board and I was, a partner in that and just talking about characters and moments and great beats and reading scripts and talking about why we love scripts. And it just kind of grew from there. And so the first time I ever wrote a TV spec, which is jumping ahead a little bit, but when I sent it to him, he goes, I knew it. I've said it all along. You're a writer. You are a writer. And so that was nice.
Do you think a lot of your success is attributed to your relationship with Greg and growing up down the hall from each other, being able to bounce ideas off of each other? Because you both are so successful that I'm wondering if that relationship or having someone like that that's brutally honest with you, that's encouraging you, all of those things, it helps you grow into the person you are.
Yeah, I would say it was sort of like a trifecta of Greg, Kevin, and then Marianne Madalena, who was Wes Craven's producing partner, because I was sort of still working for Wes and Marianne, even as I was working with Kevin, because we were doing Scream 2 and then other things together. I was friends with Greg and we were living down the hall from each other. And I had become on the set of Scream really good friends with Kevin. And so he would call me and be like, oh my God, come over. I have to write Halloween H2O and I have to work out this scene. Will you come talk me through it? And so I was constantly like between my job with Marianne and Wes, where Marianne was constantly just like putting stuff in front of me saying, can you read this? Can you tell us what you think? Will you help us do notes? You know, we really like everything you have to say, and just empowering me creatively on the job level. Greg and I with the Chinese food, you know, three nights a week talking about stories and our lives and how our lives could be good stories. And then Kevin sitting with him the other four nights of the week with Chinese food, probably, and getting into the fundamentals of story breaking and set piece breaking. So, because he just needed, he needed somebody to bounce that off. And I was, you know, I was 20. Oh my gosh. I mean, I was 25 or 26, I think. You know, there's a 5-year stretch of this. So about the time from 25 to 29, where all this was going on. And for me, Kevin was blowing up. He was completely becoming successful. Wes, because Scream was at, you know, the top of his game, had just scripts upon scripts coming his way that I was reading and getting all this kind of access to material. And Greg was just getting started. And, you know, and so I was able to watch my friend have his first TV job, you know, in our world in Dawson's Creek, and then write his first movie. And so there's this energy of creation and stories and being a part of being a guest at the party, right? In fact, I remember, speaking of an actual party, Greg got invited to the Vanity Fair Oscar party when we were like 29 years old, I think. And he took me as his plus one. And we just, I mean, like, we knew nobody, but we stood there and we looked at Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington and Nicole Kidman. And we were just like, we're in Hollywood.
Your way that you do parties is my favorite way. You sit, you go to the bar, you get your drinks, you sit in the corner, and then you look at everyone and you whisper about everyone. Yep. Like, oh my gosh, can you believe that so-and-so?
Tweet about it.
Yes.
Maybe subtly throw a tweet at it. So you're working with Wes at this time. What was your role with Wes then? I had no idea that you weren't writing independently at this time. For some reason, I think, because even talking to Marguerite McIntyre.
Oh, like, who played Candace's mom.
Played my mom.
Obviously, who's Julie's really close friend.
And a brilliant writer.
Brilliant writer who wrote on Vampire Diaries, who wrote on
Containment, the originals, and Legacies now.
Yeah. And she's like, oh yeah, I've been writing forever. I've just always written. And so it's interesting to me, I didn't know at this point that you were kind of more, what were you doing in that producer role? Like, for people that are interested, listeners that are asking themselves, well, what does that look like if you move to LA and want to be a producer?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I went to a very good film school, except I love Northwestern, and this is not a knock on them. But at the time I was like, this is a really crappy film degree, because somehow I got through 2 years of a film major. I ended up moving out of film and into just basic communications, just to have more, you know, a broad variety of classes that I wanted to take. But I didn't know how the business worked. I thought you could either be a director, and directors direct, obviously. Writers write. Producers, I thought, just got the money together, which held no interest for me. And then, or you could be a critic, an analyst, a student of film. And since I wasn't a very good student to begin with, that didn't seem like the right, you know, path for my career. So when I moved to LA, which I did, you know, with the money in my bank account and a lot of hopes and dreams, I didn't really know what to do. And somebody the night before I moved, a friend of my cousin's said to me, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't really know. I mean, there's a lot of things I'm interested in. He goes, no. He goes, when you get to Hollywood and someone asks you that question, what do you want to do? You have an answer. He goes, it doesn't need to be true. It doesn't need to be even remotely true, but have an answer. Because if someone's taking this moment to ask you what you want to do with your life and you have an answer, and that answer preferably fits into what they do, then they can help you. But if you are high in the sky, stars and everything, you know, they're not going to think of the thing that they can do to maybe give you a boost. And so
that is fantastic.
Yeah,
advice.
It's great advice, honestly. And I give it all the time, because, I mean, it seems like a lie, but it isn't, right? Yeah, I mean, it is. But it's a lie for the powers of good, right? You are basically taking an opportunity that you have to sit face to face with someone, whether it's a job interview, a mentor program, whatever, someone who's taking time out of their day, their busy day, to guide you or to hire you potentially. And you're just like focusing in on the point that matters. So one of the first job interviews I had was for an agent, and she looked at me and she said, what do you want to do here? You're new to Hollywood. What do you want to be? I said, I want to be an agent. And she goes, great, you're hired. And hired me. Like, it was that easy. That it was a 5-minute interview. And then she said, and I will pay you $290 a week. And I was like, great. Okay. So that was the advice that kind of got me smartly my first job. But very quickly, whilst working as an agent's assistant, and in this case, it was a talent agent too, so it was just actors, I realized, oh, this is terrible. This is a terrible job. Why would anybody else want this job? And so I was sort of still in that place of like, I don't really know what I want to be. I just want to be here. And then I got the job with Wes, in spite of, like I said, having no desire to be a director and no interest in horror movies. And I was, you know, responsible for his dry cleaning and getting his coffee. But I was also just sitting there doing, you know, whatever they asked me to do. And the development executives at the company started putting scripts on my desk and asking me to help read and write little summaries, what's now, you know, called coverage, basically, although I was not really writing real coverage. And they realized I could read like 5 or 6 scripts a day, sometimes like 10 scripts a day. And that I could then, after I was done reading the scripts, kind of give them like an oral synopsis of what the script had been. And I could hold it in my memory long enough to talk about it. And that I could have sort of an analytical and evaluative point of view about whether it was good or not. And within that, all of a sudden, they started giving me more and more to do. And Wes started to take my feedback and my notes into meetings with him. And I learned about this field called development, which nobody had taught me. Yeah. And I was so pissed because, you know, talk about like knowing to go out to Hollywood with a point of view about what you want. Like, of course, it's the perfect job for me. But I didn't even know it was a thing till I'd been in this town for over a year working. And so I came to it a little bit circuitously, but that is a great place to begin. And by begin, I mean post your assistant level. The other piece of advice I always give to people coming out here is whilst working at an agency is quite possibly the worst job you'll ever get, it is the singularly best option for you as an assistant to meet people, to make connections, to learn information, and to be at the center of the information pipeline. And so suck it up and do it. If you can get a job, preferably at one of the bigger agencies, which are hard to come by, but if you can get in there, mailroom, whatever, receptionist, through just a temp program, do it. Because information in Hollywood is really the thing that gets you. Some assistant down the way knows the other person looking for an assistant, and then they know 10 more people looking for an assistant. And you can say, oh, you know what? TV really interests me all of a sudden because I'm working in TV, this TV side. And then they can hear about a job that you could get being a PA in a writer's office.
It's all and that it's word incredible. Of mouth and yeah. the domino effect of
it's
knowing.
It's incredible. Yeah. And you work so hard and you get paid not that much. And less so now, I would hope, knock, knock, hashtag time's up and me too. Mm. But like not everyone in the agency business is a nice person. Mm. A lot of people are very, very loud and very aggressive and not necessarily all that polite to their coworkers. So, you know, it cannot be. I used to go home from my first agency job just crying because it was such a miserable job. But, you know, you do what you do.
So you meet these wonderful mentors, per se, in Wes and in Kevin. And I think you mentioned one other person.
Marianne.
Yeah.
And at what point do you realize like, oh, you know what? I have a project that I want to develop. Was that in the middle of working with all of them or was it afterwards?
As a writer?
Yes. Or did you start writing a pilot then eventually? Or did you discover a project you wanted to develop? What was the order of, because I think, was it Kyle XY or was it a different?
So there is, it's a little bit of a woo-woo story about why I started writing, but it's a good one, I think. And I've told it before, but I really believe in my soul that it was like my calling waking up, right? That in my soul, my calling exploded and revealed itself to me. And it is right after I was done working with Kevin, I was still kind of freelancing with Wes and Marianne to help them with some stuff just to make some money. Greg had exploded. You know, Greg was just, you know, almost an overnight sensation. And I was drifting a little bit. And I think I was like 29. And I had worked really, really hard for a lot of years. And then kind of, it's a very long story, but kind of, I don't know, just burnt out a little bit. And at 29, by the way, hilariously. But I was laying in bed sort of feeling, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. I don't know what I'm supposed to be. What am I doing? And I had a bit of a panic attack in the middle of the night and I started to cry. And I was crying deep, heavy, oh my God, I might not catch my breath.
Those racking, heaving
mm-hmm. panic sobs, which hadn't really happened to me since high school writing papers. My mom being like, what's wrong? I can't do this. And then out of nowhere, a voice came into my head and it said, you need to write.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a voice from God, only I'm not religious. Yeah. So just a voice.
Just a,
yep. Yeah. You need to write. You need to be a writer. And I thought, okay, well, okay, how do I do that? And then I realized I had been watching all this TV. It was a golden age, first golden age, pre-Lost, but basically right around The Sopranos, first golden age of television. There's everything great. So I said, all right, I'm going to write a TV spec, which is what you do. Like you write a spec episode of a show that's on the air. And I chose Buffy and I sat and I, over 10 days, came up with the whole idea for Buffy, wrote the whole thing, sent it to Greg, who said, circling back, I knew it, I knew it, I knew it. And then that, I thought, was the beginning of what would have been my writing career. And that was when I was 29. And then a series of unfortunate events prevented that from coming to pass. And it's something I never really talk about, but it's like, it scarred me for close to a decade. And what it was, and I'll try to, like, I don't know, maybe I'll protect the names of the innocent, maybe I won't. But what happened was Greg said, I'm going to hire you on Everwood if it gets picked up. And he said, you're going to be a writer and a producer. And I'm so happy. I'd helped him cast the show. I'd helped him develop the script. And so for him, it was like a way to finally get to work together with me as an actual writer.
And on a show that's so iconic. I loved that show growing up.
And so it got picked up, you know, for to go to series after the pilot. And he called and he said, they're going to call and make an offer. Here's what they're going to pay you. This is so great. I'm so happy. And I was like, woohoo, going to be a writer. You know, by the way, the easiest way in, which is such bullshit, which is why this story, it's probably good that the story took a dark turn.
But I would take it, just to take it on a tangent for a second, you did different kind of work to get there.
True.
A lot of different kind of work. So
yes. Okay. And I did. And I had been producing and I'd actually ended up, been writing quite a lot, just not as a writer, you know, just helping. And so then, and by the way, it should be made clear that I was down to like the last $5 to my name. I was definitely not in a good financial place. And I waited for that call to come and waited another day and waited another day. And then Greg and his partner called me and they're like, we have some news and it's not good. And the news was that somebody at the WB had refused to hire me because of their experience with me when I worked for Kevin on Dawson's Creek. They did not like me. They thought I was a bad person. And they essentially blackballed me from the WB network. And but by the way, this is the time when like all I watch is the WB. I am basically 17 years old in my soul, like, and will be forever. And the WB was like Felicity and Buffy and Dawson's. And I mean, everything.
Roswell. The original.
And gosh, like I said, it wasn't 99. Hang on a second. Let me think about, oh no. Yeah. Cause it would have been 2001, I guess. And I got blackballed. And Greg, he's like, Julie, I literally wrote a 6-page letter to this person explaining how much I need you. And the response was, if you need her, you can pay her out of your own pocket and put her in an office somewhere off grounds of the offices of Everwood, because that woman, quote, that woman will never work at the WB again.
Did you look like his ex-wife or something? I'm trying to understand this.
So, okay. So I guess the moral of the story, we don't get into the more of the details, but it took me about 10 years to kind of learn the lesson here, mm-hmm. because basically what I was characterized as by this person was a power-hungry control freak. who he did not want anywhere near his business. And the reason he characterized me as a power-hungry control freak was because when I worked on Dawson's Creek, I got very, very, very involved. Even though I hadn't been hired by the network, I was not a writer on the show. I was not a producer on the show. I worked for Kevin. And as Kevin's partner in crime and as his executive, and he said to me, he was directing a movie at the time, he said, get in there and make sure that things are going well. You know what I like. You'll know if it goes down the wrong road. So just keep me posted until I can get back in there. And then when Kevin did get back in there, then by then it was him, me, and Greg basically like churning and churning and churning together as a team for a good chunk of the season. And not a great experience for anybody involved. I think probably the writers would agree with the power-hungry control freak label, because I was trying to make Kevin happy and I loved that show so deeply and had sort of my opinions, which I, you know, were an extension of Kevin's opinions. And so in my mind, it was my job and sort of my role as a lover of all things Dawson's Creek to contribute and to participate and to be a voice there.
But I'm going to ask the question mm-hmm. that I think some might be thinking. Do you think that you were viewed as a power hungry control freak, that an element of that was because you're a woman and not a man in that role, saying, hey, this is the job I'm here to do, but it came... Do you think there's an element of that, or do you think it was different?
I think a lot of things. Like I, you know, when the whole Me Too movement started, I was like, oh, have I ever really been mistreated, you know, in you know, whether it be sexually harassed or even just mistreated because I'm female. And that was the one I kept circling back to. Mm. But, you know, there's an accountability that we all have to take for the way that we are perceived. And as much as we can also then wake up one day and be like, wait a second, like, I don't think you would have said that about a man, you know? And what I realized that I had done is blindly jumped into an environment without thinking politics, without thinking hierarchy, without thinking like that I wasn't even an employee of the show. And because that's how Kevin and I worked, and ultimately Greg too, because we were all this little like core, it just felt so natural for me to be a part of all the decisions and to be the one giving notes on the scripts and to be the one, you know, at like helping with the rewrites and all that stuff. But nobody knew that. Like nobody knew what I was doing to help. And they just saw me as either the person who was speaking up when they shouldn't speak, you know, like had no business being in the room in the first place, the person who was sort of steamrolling over other writers, the person who was, I went to a marketing meeting with Kevin, who was upset about the lack of marketing in season two. And I was taking a stand, sort of helping him support his argument with big shots. And I'm not even working on the show, you know? So I was just fucking dumb in that way. And coming totally from the heart, you know, like everything from the heart. And also being in a very intense working relationship with Kevin, where we had a lot to do. And he gave me all this, you know, rope with which to, I guess, hang myself, but freedom. And I pissed off people and they really did not like it. This one person in particular really did not like it.
So if we can learn from this, because I'm really trying to understand what the lesson is then. Is it know your place in your new workplace? Or what have you, after 10 years, come to?
Go ahead, Candace.
Well, we've had an episode about failure and we talked about, like, I think that everyone needs to be fired at some point in their life.
Yes.
Like, someone needs to, like, have a, like, where you don't get it, or like that big learning lesson of like, oh man, you know, it's just part of it. And in like, especially when you're young or overstepping your boundaries, where someone has to be like, excuse me, that isn't your place. This actually isn't your job, and you're overspeaking someone else. But do you think, was this the first time that you'd really had that in your life, where you just like, oh
yeah,
man?
Well, I had gotten kicked out of the school play my senior year in high school. It was the first time I had the lead. And I was very excited about that. But I got sick for a week. And then on the last day of being sick, which was the day before tech rehearsals, there was a soccer game at our school, was going to like soccer playoffs. And I ditched the rehearsal and went to the soccer game, and they fired my ass off the school play. And I'm like, well, duh, of course. But at the time it was like very traumatic. I'm going to ask you guys to help me keep track of this because there's like 3 points that I want to make sure it's like I can stay in a linear path. I think one is basic youth and naivete. Two is entitlement. And three is perhaps a bit of the being a young woman in what is not a young woman's game. It's certainly not at that point. The naivete I touched on already a little, which is just like, come on, Julie, this is not summer camp. This is not the playground. This is a $1 billion/$1 trillion industry run by CEOs and people like who have been doing this forever. And who the fuck do you think you are going in there and just like steamrolling all over everybody else's jobs? Now, was I doing it with malintention? No.
I admire your guts.
Yeah.
I have
yeah.
to say, I really do. I do. And I know you had to learn that lesson, but man, I really respect it at the same time. So I get it at the same time.
It was dumb. It was dumb, but it was pure. It was who I was. Right. And by the way, I say this all the time and I'll circle back to this in entitlement, but like, I'm still that same person. Only now I'm in charge and people think I'm awesome, right? I'm still like that. Now, what hurt so much was getting characterized as power hungry because control freak, it took me about a decade to realize like, actually I am like, I'm a workaholic. And part of being a workaholic is feeling like you need to have your hand in every single detail and that you need to weigh in and be there and, you know, and do the work. And so I was very probably aggressive and the things that I felt like I needed to control. And over the years, I taught myself how to not be that way anymore. But the power hungry thing really just sat with me and I felt so mischaracterized and so misunderstood. And that was the heartbreak. And, you know, also when you're 29 years old and you find out that all these people that you were working with don't like you, like talk about a humbling experience. And that it took me still I have deep insecurities as a result of probably that slap in the face, but a good 10 years to even get my like sort of groove back, you know, to get my jujus and my mojo and in order and feel confident again. So youth and just remembering that this is a business with people in it who really have been doing it for quite a long time and they are not wrong. Sometimes they are, but you are not right. Sometimes you are, but just, you know, temper it all. Be a little bit less oblivious, be a little bit more in tune with, you know, read the room,
yeah.
read your place read in the room, which kind of takes me to the entitlement thing because I mean, now here's where my old lady, you know, my old lady, you know, personality comes out, but my friends and I we're all in our 40s. All we do is sit around and marvel over how unbearingly entitled 20-somethings are. And we're always just like, oh, the millennials, you know, millennial this, millennial that. But when I look back at what I was doing back then and what the way I behaved in my career in my 20s, there was a big level of entitlement that I wasn't even recognizing I had. And it's a very fine line, Kayla, because thank you for saying that you think it's badass. And part of it is badass, right?
It is. Like, not many people would have the wherewithal within them to do that.
The blind guts.
Serious.
The balls.
And, but it comes at a price. When all is said and done, this is a town of creative people, filmmakers, storytellers, and artists, in spite of also being a major multi-trillion-dollar, you know, business run by CEOs. And within limits and within reasons, there is a level of entitlement that kind of comes with raw talent that sometimes you end up realizing, like, I want to let this person be. I don't want to humiliate them. I don't want to humble them. I don't want to put them back in their place because what's happening in front of my eyes is something really special. And I think that where it went wrong for me is that Greg and Kevin and Marianne and Wes, as they nurtured me up through my 20s, saw something special in me. And I just became accustomed to being special in that way and to believing that the value I was adding was so important and so needed that it never occurred to me that somebody could be looking at me through a completely different prism. Mm-hmm. And that what other people might see as, oh, look, she's such a hard worker and she's really contributing so much. Somebody else might see as, who does she think she is? Get that woman, that woman, mm-hmm. I will never forget. Get that woman out of my space, you know? And I honestly think I worked with some women coming up through my years. One who was a complete raging ball buster. Rat is cool as chick in town, but when she got mad, you could hear her screaming from two blocks away. And she really struggled with her temper. And I remember thinking, like, I don't ever want to have to be that. I don't want to have to be the person that has to scream like a man do in order to get taken seriously. And then I've worked with other people who, like, you know, dressed to the nines, hair in perfect, you know, perfect shape, like perfect face of makeup, gorgeous in a ball gown, like really presenting themselves as classy, beautiful, hardworking professionals who they themselves are struggling so much to get taken seriously. And I remember thinking, well, I don't want to be that either. I don't want to have to put so much work into my appearance and my body and my clothes and my hair. That's exhausting, just in hopes that I'll fit into some sense of like Hollywood style or chic, or, you know, that I'm like, you know, in the sorority. So I never want to be that.
Well, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to jump into Julie's 30s and hear about when she was ready to finally share her own story.
This is not a 9-part series, yeah. About my one decade to the next.
We'll be back right after the break.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It's time to get more in 2024. I know for me, one of my goals is to feel really strong this year. And honestly, so far, so good. Because that's where 310 Nutrition comes in. It's helping me and our listeners in the new year with protein and super rich food products with so many options and flavors. Right now I have the Chocolate Bliss and Caramel Sundae, and they are both so delicious. I have to hide them from my husband so that he doesn't steal them too. They're a triplex protein blend, plant-based proteins that include pea, brown rice, and pumpkin that leave me feeling full. 310 Nutrition also has a hydrate electrolyte drink mix. My favorite is the peach mango flavor. So not only am I hydrating and drinking water, I have an electrolyte blend, vitamin blend, and it's sugar-free. With one stick of Hydrate Mix into 16 ounces of water, and it can provide the same amount of hydration equal to drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Thank you. This way I can keep my resolution, keep feeling strong, have greater focus, feel refreshed, and maintain my hydration without having to drink as much. One of my favorite refreshing water enhancers they have is the lemonade flavor. It gives me energy. This one's also sugar-free. It's used with real lemons and it's pH balanced. And this also offers the same hydration as 2 to 3 bottles of water. Right now, 3-10 is celebrating a new year of goals with code CHALLENGED and giving our listeners 50% off up to $100 for your first order. With so many sample packs, new products, it's really fun and easy to put together an order or start a subscription on products that you know you'll use and will help you keep your resolution. So go to 310nutrition.com and use the code CHALLENGED right now for 50% up to $100 for your first order. That's 310-nutrition.com and use code CHALLENGED. It's all the good stuff your body needs in flavors you crave. So be healthier effortlessly.
So we're sitting here talking about this dinner that we were all at Kevin's house the other week. And I'm thinking back about your guys. I think it was your very first podcast about FOMO and Instagram and how everyone's like curating their best lives and you never just live the moment. And we were at a dinner with Kevin Williamson and Paul Wesley and his wife.
Who is the fanciest house, by the way? Yes, Kevin's by the way. House is so fancy.
And Candace and Joe and Kayla and Tanner and me and Brett Matthews. And not a single person was on the gram. There were no pictures. There was not. And I thought, well, that's when you really settled into your life and feel comfortable in your own space is when you don't need to like gather for the group shot that ends up on Instagram just because you were hanging out with a bunch of Vampire Diaries people.
I know. It's true. Never. Yeah. Anytime I see like... Never. I'm always just like, oh man, well, I guess maybe we should have taken one, but it's so bad. I mean, even when we've all done conventions together, I'm just like, maybe we should take a, no, we're all just kind of like hanging. We spend the whole time together, but then no one ends up like being like, hey guys, let's take the shot.
I think it's also such a family vibe that for me anyways, when I'm with quote unquote family, you know, and friends with the family you choose, you kind of let your hair down to a point where you almost want to treasure that moment and more so than even putting it on Instagram. I don't know. There's something about keeping it private that makes it even more special.
Well, so much of Instagram now is so exploitive. You're like, I was laughing at Tyler Blackburn. I was on the set of Roswell right before Christmas. And I was like, dude, get over here. I'm putting you in my Insta story. You have like 13 million followers. Get over here.
And no shame.
No shame. Just exploit the hell out of that. So anyway, I just thought that was a nice button on your your concerns from episode one.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. So we're back. So you've been blackballed from Warner Brothers. You're 29 years old. And what do you do next?
Well, you go through an awkward shared 30th birthday party with Greg, your best friend, who is about to basically embark on the most magnificent chapter of his career as you are poor and unemployed.
Now, let me ask and you shamed this, because we've all been there. Is there jealousy there a little bit? Is it a tinge or is it not jealousy? Is it sadness? What emotion goes around with that? Because as happy as you are for your friend, it's also hard sometimes when one is so on top and one isn't.
Greg just exudes gift. Greg is very gifted and Greg has been gifted his whole life. And certainly when we were in our 20s, and it just was so obvious to me how gifted he was. And so when his success began for me, I was like, ta-da, of course. And so I was very happy for him to have that. But what was strange about it is then my insecurity kicked in because suddenly then I was the one without the job and the one without any money and the one who needed help, whereas the roles had been completely reversed at the beginning of our professional friendship. Because when he and I used to get together. He was the one that didn't know what he wanted to do. And he was the one that wasn't writing. And he was the one that didn't have a writing career. And, you know, I was like, oh, let's, you know, let me introduce you to Kevin. And here's Dawson's Creek. And Kevin was like, I want to sell this pitch that Greg has. And so I'm going to hire him as a writer on Dawson's Creek and give him a job. So I had been, rightfully so, because Greg is so talented, I'd been like blowing him up. And then suddenly I was like the loser. I had to borrow money from him, you know, which was, it's humiliating, you know, like so much of our own swagger in this town comes from our confidence. In fact, the people who have no confidence and fake swagger are the worst, in my opinion, because they're the ones that are like, need to be at all the parties and need to do all the meetings and the networking. And you're just like, oh God, like, just own some piece of yourself that you believe in. You know, I had all this confidence, but had all been sort of ripped out from under me. And so I didn't know how to fake swagger. I just was sort of like, help. So yes, I launched my 30th year in a real bad spot.
Wow.
And I think that went on, that little bad spot went on for 2 years, because I didn't want anybody to know that I needed a job. Mm. I just wanted somebody to call and give me a job, which now I know is really dumb. But, you know, perception being 9/10 of the law, like, I didn't want people to think I was doing anything but chasing my dreams and, you know, developing my own stuff and, you know, trying to be a producer and all those things that you think, oh, like, no one's going to know that I'm unemployed if I behave like this. I didn't ever want to have to call around and, like, go on job interviews and look for work, because I had sort of a meteoric rise in my 20s working for Kevin. I was a producer practically by the time I was 30. And I didn't want to have to go and say, oh, do you need an executive? You know, a mid-level executive, I'm looking. So I just didn't look. And I just lived off credit cards and Greg.
Oh my God.
And Wes and Marianne, God bless them, like, basically called up and they're like, we need some help with this thing we're doing. Will you come freelance again for us? And that turned into basically 3 years of my life, because we ended up making Cursed, which is the movie that Kevin wrote about werewolves in Hollywood and that Wes directed. And I got hired on that. And it took us 3 years. And I won't go into that story. That's a whole other podcast that we should do.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's such a good story, though.
We need to have that be a singular podcast episode.
It's such a good story. But 3 years to make a movie, which we made, by the way, like 4 times. And by the end of that movie, I was writing the reshoot pages, because Kevin got so annoyed about 2/3 of the way through the process. He was like, I am done with this. Like, they can all go fuck themselves. Like, I've got other things to do. And so I was the one left to, like, you know, when we were reshooting the ending for the 3rd time to write those pages. So that's kind of, in its own strange way, how the writing thing came back around for me. And also within that, I had kind of doubled down again on wanting to be a writer. And so I had this other script that I sent to 2 new agents and said, if you want to sign me, I'm available. And they did. And it was so great. And they're like, this is awesome. We're going to rep you. And then, like, 2 months later, they called and they're like, hey, there's this executive job that we think you'd really be great for. Do you want it? And I thought, oh, all right, well, I guess I'm not a writer. It's cool. Like, you know, let's not get embarrassing about it, you know? But the job was for a management company called Bender Spink, and they needed somebody to run TV production for them, to take all their clients and say, who has a TV idea, and let me help you shape it and let me help you sell it. And then if it gets made, I'll produce it. And in my head, I thought, well, if I'm producing, once it's one step closer to, at some point in success, being able to say, and how about if I write one too, you know? So my entire goal was just get a TV show on the air so that one day I could say, oh, can I write a script, an episode of it? And that somebody might say yes, and that I would finally be a writer. And that's basically exactly what happened. I secreted myself into my actual writing career. And that was Kyle XY, a show that I produced the pilot for Bender Spink, and then was a producer on the series. And instead of waiting 3 years in success to get my first shot at writing, it was episode 4 of season 1 that they asked me to write, and I did, and they liked it, and it just kind of went on from there. And that was the beginning of everything. Mm-hmm. And Kyle XY ended just as Vampire Diaries was being born. And
what's that?
I know, right? By the way, it's so funny. I was just thinking about Vampire Diaries literally today. I mean, it's on my mind a lot, but I was remembering the party at Kevin's house that we had the series finale.
Oh.
And how I had, when the show ended, I had this massive wave of like, oh, and I think it was even not even when that episode aired. It was like 2 hours later. No, it was when that episode aired because it had already aired on the East Coast. And I thought, short of Hawaii, the Vampire Diaries is now officially over. And this whole 9-year, 8-year chapter of my life is now done. And that was a big moment of like this wave of kind of grief passed over me. Mm-hmm. And it was crazy.
It's interesting how much you have to mourn the end of that story. And yeah. I think we all felt that. And I know you guys had been on this show for so long, but even just coming back for the ending and feeling the amount of emotion and the amount of love that and heart that was put into that show. I don't know if everyone really truly gives that much of themselves to every piece of art that they do.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only way I know how to do it.
Yeah.
And yet it's weird. And it's nice, but it's weird. And I think about like, so at the end of my 20s, I am now blackballed from the WB. The WB in my mid 30s turns into the CW.
Yes.
And lo and behold, because nobody wants me to write the Vampire Diaries, but they sure as hell want Kevin to write the Vampire Diaries. And Kevin is sure as hell not going to write the Vampire Diaries without me.
Did you find it or did he find it or was it brought to you?
It was
you
brought
guys?
To us at lunch, me and Kev. Kevin and I were, thanks mom, having lunch with our friend Jen Breslow, who you guys know and love. Mm-hmm. One day I hope you tell your time capsule story, but I won't ruin it for the audience. But we were having lunch with Jen and we were just talking and catching up, and she worked at the CW and we were talking about Twilight and True Blood and vampires and how surely the vampire genre must be dead by now. And she goes, well, I hope not, because I'm trying to find writers for this book series that we have. And we talked about it for a minute. Kevin remembered it from a few years back because somebody had sent it to him to make a movie out of. And she just was like, do you guys want to write it? And he goes, no. And I said, yeah. And then he said, okay, fine. And then we did. But now I'm back in the room where it happens. And every word that comes out of my mouth, I am terrified, because Peter Roth, who's the head of Warner Brothers at the time, knew that whole the WB story. He was right there in the middle of it. So he remembers me probably as the girl that got blacklisted from the WB. There are executives in that room that knew the story, and whether they remembered it or not, in my head, I was on such like delicate earth there. Mm. Like I was just, but my personality is, I'm not a wallflower. You know, like it's really, really, really hard for me to sit back and say nothing. It is really difficult for me to sit in a room and not participate. And when I get into a zone, like a creative zone or a talk zone, like a dinner party zone, we'll call it, yeah, I lose track of how much I'm talking and how much I'm saying, because I'm just so engaged in the moment. And then I will go home later, replay the whole thing in my head and be like, Julie, shut up. Why are you talking? Why did you say that to Don Ostroff? Who do you think you are?
Who's the head of the CW
at the time? Who do you think you are? And so the first literally 2 years of the Vampire Diaries, when Kevin was there, was me basically relitigating my shame at WB in my head. Every time we had a meeting, every time we had a network notes call, every time I like was, you know, in the presence of the bosses, I was either, you know, sitting on my hands, trying not to say too much, or over talking because that's just my personality. And then going home and suffering and being like, oh my God, I'm doing it all over again. I'm just ruining it all over again.
God, from my perspective at that time, you're the most powerful, like talented, like woman who's got all of her shit together and quite intimidating. So that's fascinating. No, I'm really being serious. So that's fascinating to me that was really happening.
Yeah, it was really happening. I mean, I grew into my confidence on that show because how couldn't you? You know,
yeah.
we were doing all the work and people loved it. And so at a certain point, you can't be insecure about that because people love what you're doing and you're doing it really well, even though the process is difficult. It's like really, really well received. So yes, Blossom Julie, like came out of her shell and, you know, was very confident about it to a certain degree, but just really laden with deep, deep, deep insecurity and fear that I was going to end up sort of oversharing or over-talking myself or being entitled or being too, you know, too much out of that position.
Well, we talked before and we've talked a lot about the fact that season one, you and Kevin were in LA for most of it because just scripts trying to keep up with the pace of everything and new scripts coming out and rewrites. And when did you start? I'm trying to remember, when did you start coming out more? Was it season two or season three? Because when did Kevin also move on to start working on different shows? Because at that point, it went from you and it was always you and Kevin.
Yes.
And then there was a shift into either season two or three where you were running the ship essentially.
Yeah. It was Kevin and Julie, Kevin and Julie, Kevin and Julie. And as a result, we were in Atlanta only in pockets, little small pockets, and didn't get to have a lot of the fun that one has when making a show. We were just working all the time and sort of drowning in our own workaholism and in our own stress. In season two, because Vampire Diaries was such a hit, Warner Brothers asked Kevin if he would lend a helping hand and help them produce the Secret Circle pilot. And that ended up taking quite a bit of time, right around the time when we decided we had to kill Aunt Jenna.
Sarah Canning.
Poor Sarah. And so I had to come out and tell her that we were doing this. And it was so dramatic and so painful. And like I wanted to vomit. Mm-hmm. And then she, I think, wanted to punch me. And
which
like,
is so the opposite of her personality.
She's like the nicest person in the whole world. And she was so mad at me. And I, because that was such a scarring experience, we all went out drinking. Like, I think Candace and Matt and Zach and I went out drinking and just started talking. And then suddenly, like, for every night we were out doing something and every, like, weekend we were all together. And I just kept coming back and coming back because I could, because I was finally, outside of killing Aunt Jenna, like, finally having fun. Mm. And finally getting to know the people that I was writing for and feeling like I was part of that sort of the world and the voice and the Atlanta experience and all of that. And so everything kind of started to change really then.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Okay, so at what point, because yes, we were all very bonded. We all spent a lot of time together. We all were working crazy hours. I mean, as much as we were working hard, we were playing hard. And it was the best. It was just a dream. At what point did you kind of wake up one day and just go, okay, I got this. I am the executive producer of this show.
Or did you ever feel that way?
Did you ever feel that way? Or was it slowly over time? Or was it just one day you woke up?
So it took a long time to get there. And intermittently that feeling would go away too. But basically when Kevin left the show after season two, I was on my own season three. And thankfully, Caroline Dries had come up the ranks and was now sort of my number two, my co-executive producer, godsend lifesaver. But I was the one that had to keep the Vampire Diaries on the air and good. And I was terrified because, you know.
That's a huge load of pressure.
Yes. Speaking of gifted people, I mean, Kevin Williamson is fucking brilliant. Like, he is so, so, so gifted, and his style and his voice and the way that he thinks of story twists and moments and the dialogue, everything about him is so unique. And I grew up under him trying to write like him, but he has a signature thing that I was worried, oh God, what if without that, the show doesn't work? Because it was possible, you know? And so I drove myself into this deep, deep, deep workaholic, crazy emotional spiral for the first part of season three. Like Caroline could tell you guys stories of me like coming to her office and just bursting into tears because I was so scared. And it wasn't going well logistically. We got a lot of bad cuts. The actors were all sort of feeling, the actors, Candace, you weren't, you were wonderful.
I'm slipping her a 20 as she's saying this. So
like, you know, they were feeling, one, the sort of absence of Kevin. They were feeling the absence of Marcos, who was our producer-director, who had come and gone over the first two seasons. The originals were, you know, in the picture and getting a lot of great stories. And, you know, there was some insecurity about some of that from some of people not in this room. And and it was just hard. And season three on a hit TV show is the year where all the actors start to feel trapped and like they're stuck in the show for the rest of their lives and they're going to age out of their own hireability while they're on this vampire show. And so there's that and there's all this going on. But basically what happened was I sort of hit rock bottom working so hard. But we got to what I would say is probably episode 305, which is The Reckoning, and then the originals episode, which was 8, the introduction.
I'm so impressed that you know episode
and,
names
oh, I do.
After
it's
this
crazy.
Point. That's
yeah.
amazing.
And the ratings went up. And I remember seeing, I don't remember which episode it was, might have been Smells Like Teen Spirit. It was right in that little pocket of time. And the ratings went up in season 3, which never happens.
Wow.
And I thought, oh my God, like I did it. I almost died. I almost went completely mad. I shed a lot of tears. I probably really handled myself in a way that I would not want to do again, but I did it. The show's good. People like it. More people are liking it. And I'm going to make it. I'm going to do it. And that was the moment.
I'm so happy you took the moment to celebrate that because so many times in life we brush over the wins and then we just kind of only focus on the really hard times. And I think you so deserved to celebrate that.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to know that you still within all that had the wherewithal to celebrate.
Well, and not only could I celebrate it, but that was also the moment when I thought, okay, now I have to do this better. Like I will die, literally die. If I keep going at this the way that I've been going at it, I have got nobody in my corner except poor Caroline, who is probably going to die with me because I'm overworking her. I have a room full of writers that I don't really quite know what to do with and who don't really, they think I'm like the killer of joy because I'm the one that was killing the pitches. And I need to do something different. And I just switched on a dime. And I said, from this day forward, I'm going to look for the gifted qualities of every writer in this room. And I'm going to build them up. And I'm going to say, if you're good at this one thing, then I'm going to make you do that. And if you're good at this, then I'm going to build you up to do that. And suddenly Caroline, you know, even got better. She was already amazing. Michael Narducci stepped out of the shadows and became one of the MVPs. And then Brett Matthews started with us and, you know, it's now my show running partner. And all these writers that had been sort of in my mind the quiet enemy because I didn't know what to do with them now were able to shine and thrive and find their own voice and their confidence in the experience like I had had to find mine. Mm-hmm. And so once I found mine, I was able to sort of help pave the way for people to find theirs. And then suddenly from that became, let's do a spinoff. Let's do the original spinoff. Oh, great. Michael Narducci's really good at writing class. Let's get him over there. Let's do Containment. This show that I, you know, was so excited that wasn't part of the vampire franchise. Let's do The Tomorrow People with Greg Berlanti, because it was a show we used to watch on Nickelodeon when we were kids and wow. We talked about in college. And then the world opened up and I could do it because I had people that I trusted who, in a lot of ways, like I will go to the grave saying Michael Narducci is a better writer than I am in many ways, if not always. And so I could let him be the originals, you know, and be there to help him. And that is when I think you guys, I know we talked about wanting to talk about like mentoring and finding, you know, and building up other people. And that's how Karina came into the picture. And it really, it's circling back to the fact that at the beginning of my career, I had people who believed in me and who let me flourish almost to their own detriment because I flourished my way right into exile. But like, that's just how I was treated. And so I really wanted other people to flourish as a result of the experience they're having with me. Now, would I call myself a great mentor? No, absolutely not. I don't do much to tell people how to do things. I just am like, you're coming along on this ride with me. And if you're good, like I think you are going to soar. And then I sort of like throw them out of the nest and hope that all goes well. But I give them the opportunity, which I didn't realize until I had the wisdom to look back and have talked to a lot of my friends who have struggled their whole career for just one person to give them a break. How few people are comfortable doing that. You know, most people are so territorial about their own success or their own, what they have, and they don't want to share it. And for me, sharing it made me able to not be insane when I did my job and to not want to die when I did my job, to build friendships that I hadn't been able to build because I've been working like a crazy person for all these years, and to have a life and to broaden my business and to build other people's business. And it's a good way to go.
Well, there's always been this idea of a boys club in Hollywood. And I think it's how many women can get in the room in the boys club and find and make their own space in there, when it's like, whoa, why don't we make our own fucking club? And I feel like that's something you've done so wonderfully. And it's not necessarily that you only let women in and not men. I mean, it's exactly what you just said. You've recognized the gifts and talents in so many people, and you're just encouraging them along the way. And it's been so fun to be a part of a show where, you know, over the course of 8 years, there were people that started off as PAs that then were like running the ship by the end of it. Or someone like Karina, who went from, you know, interviewing us as a journalist, and now here she is, you know, show running her own show, which you're producing with her and also directing on. I mean, so even if you don't feel like you're a mentor, I think you living your own path and you living your truth, and I think that's the mentoring that you don't even realize that you're doing. It's by example.
And that's the lesson I think that you learn as, you know, your 20s are horrible. They're just horrible. Let's be real. You think they're the best time of your life. They're not. They're terrible. It's your most insecure time. You have no money. You know, like relationships are terrifying, and stuff that seems so real is not, you know. And then your 30s, you think, okay, now I finally got it, right? Only to look back on your 30s and realize, well, those were terrible. But what happens as you get older is you're like, everything contextualizes itself. Your anxiety, you realize, oh, I'm always going to be the one that goes home at the end of a long day, lays in bed and replays the entire day in my head and kicks myself for everything stupid I said. I'm always going to be that person. I'm never going to grow out of that. But as someone now in my 40s, I can think, okay, well, I'm doing all right. And I still seem to have friends and people still seem to respect me, and I need to take better care of myself and not stop punishing myself so much. We punish ourselves so much when we're young, and it never goes away, but we can treat ourselves with more respect with the more information and knowledge we have about how we've lived our lives. Professionally, I said, everything that got me into trouble in my 20s, I am still that way. I have not learned a goddamn lesson in some ways, except other than that I had that experience of being humiliated or being sort of torn down for who I was. And so now I can look and say, all right, what parts of me am I unwilling to change? Because that's just who I am. And what parts of me can I be smart enough about tempering for the audience? Know your audience, you know? Know that this person isn't going to take well to that side of your personality. Know that, like, this is a situation where you might be more successful if you remain quiet. Or, you know that respect, you know, for your elders, so to speak, even as you get older, still goes a long way. And I also always talk about this this example, circling back to entitlement and how we're also big and bold and believing of what we can do and what we're capable of in our 20s. But the thing that you don't realize until you get deep into decades later is that you might have the skill set and the talent and the ability to do all the things and achieve all your dreams in that way. But what you don't have is the intelligence and the sort of power of experiential competence. And confidence born out of experience is completely different than the natural confidence that we have, like just by being like having our own swagger. And I always tell the story of like the thing that to me defines experiential confidence is the person that can pick up the phone and call, say, the president of the United States when there's a problem and the president will take their call. So we're not calling the president in Hollywood, but who are we calling? Who can pick up the phone and dial Julia Roberts or Stacey Snyder, the head of Fox or whatever she is now, you know, or, you know, any of the big wigs and get their call taken? People with experience ultimately. And everything else is just, you know, running around doing the work, but like having the power, which frankly, I don't have that yet. Like that's my next step is like, how can I be that confident that I can pick up the phone and dial Julia Roberts, for lack of a better example, and know with all confidence that she'll be looking forward to taking my call. And that's the scary stuff, but it's fun.
So we all know that, like, you are the Shonda Rhimes of the CW.
Of and,
but what are your goals moving forward? I mean, now look at all these shows that you're a part of, and it's kind of like your babies are out, and obviously you're still going to be raising them. But what is your next goal? Are you going to continue directing? Do you want to direct more? Do you want to kind of get into film? Are you just more in love with television? What stories do you see yourself telling and how?
I love television so much that I can't see a world in which I'm ever not making television. That being said, my 3-year plan for sure is I really, really want to direct a movie. Because I would love to be able to do that job and play that role of like the visual storyteller in a window where I am not juggling 10 other jobs at the same time. I love directing so much. I love directing television, but I'm literally like prepping Roswell and writing legacies on the weekend and doing notes for the originals, you know, during the production meeting and then on set juggling staffing meetings and staffing calls. And I've never been able to immerse myself into a story and a world and build it from scratch and actually be the visionary of the whole piece. And I just think that that would be a lot of fun. And I also want to continue to nurture the Karinas of this world and the Narducci's and the Drees. Although Drees is now, she doesn't need me. She's doing this fine. She's doing Batwoman. And the Bretts and make more shows that the people I love and that the writers I really admire want to make so that I can use, you know, the fact that the CW likes me and would happily make TV shows with me till, you know, they don't exist anymore until I'm dead and see if that experience can get translated over into other people getting to make their TV shows. Because being the sort of boss of your own thing is a thrill that you can't even imagine. I mean, it's terrifying and it's all those things, but being the sort of master of your own domain, the leader of your own universe, whatever you want to call it, but being the mother of your creation is a really powerful experience. And talk about confidence building, you know, talk about swagger. You really do. You come out of it feeling like you can do anything. And that's pretty nice.
Is there a story that has come to you that you haven't told yet?
There isn't. And what's funny is, because this goes, you can file this away under professional insecurity that never goes away. Candace, you said, oh, I just assumed you must have always been writing. No. And writers give advice to other writers and say, what should I do if I want to be a writer? And writers will say, always be writing. I'm never writing. I'm writing for my job, day in, day out. And when my job is not taking my time, which is the occasional midday Saturday or like 2 weeks at the end of May, I am nowhere near a pen, a paper, a story. Mm-hmm. I have no drawer full of ideas that I've never, you know, that I've never written that are just waiting. I don't have a file cabinet full of half-finished scripts. I literally started to write on Kyle XY and have been working like a crazy person ever since. And coming up now with Legacies finishing its first season and Roswell finishing its first season and a little bit of a break before we go into season two, it's the first time I have ever been able to sit down and ask myself, what story do you want to tell? And let me tell you, that's the most beautiful thing that can happen to a writer. And for me personally, my worst nightmare, my absolute fucking worst nightmare, because I actually have to dig into myself. And I'm not writing vampires and I'm not building on the world of Vampire Diaries for its third spinoff, or I'm not rebooting a Roswell, you know, television show, or I have to start from scratch. And that's me back in high school with the blank page of the paper that's due tomorrow and realizing I have no idea what to write. And it's wild.
Well, we have a feeling you're going to get an A, whatever paper it is that you write.
Nice and callback,
and
Candace.
That's going to have to be the next episode where we speak to you to hear all about that. Thank you so much for being a part of and just supporting it from day one. Like, you've been like such an awesome champion, like support, like being like, you guys got this, and excited for this whole, you know, podcast journey that we've been on.
And so, just to like push us as creators to create our own content and something. And I know that we both feel so inspired by you, and you have mentored us, whether you have been aware of it or not. And I really hope you listeners can find these pockets of brilliance that Julie shares and implement them into your own life. And please come back on. I feel like we just only cracked the beginning of this, and I can't believe time flew by so fast. So,
I know. And I, like I said, would love to just talk and talk and talk till we all run out of things to say. But thank you for letting me babble as much as I did. And I do want to say, and you don't have to use this, but but in under the category of great Vampire Diaries tidbits, what I have loved is seeing you two build this brand for yourselves and this career for yourselves. And I mean, these two became friends on the pilot of a TV show.
On the airplane ride.
On the airplane ride, which I had forgotten. Then I heard on the Michael Flamis thing that I was like, oh yeah, that's right. You guys flew with Kat and me and
Diane
I was on
Keaton.
The plane with Trevino and Zach. And watching you guys, I mean, you've been at each other's weddings. You've been at, you know, all the big moments. You have been best girlfriends this whole time. And it's so real. And especially actors are not always that real. And acting friendships are rarely that real and supportive. And it's just amazing. And
thank
I love
you.
It. And honestly, like, Vicky, of course, was one of my favorite characters. But like, I always say, like, the reason Vicky Donovan couldn't like permanently die is because we all couldn't really live a world in the Vampire Diaries where Kayla wasn't around.
I feel the same, where like my heart was so with that show that it means so much to me. So thank you. Appreciate that. But it's true. You, because of you, we have now made lifelong friends.
Yeah.
And I mean, because of the decisions you guys made. And it's just so crazy how one decision can affect you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, and like, really, we're cool. Friends with Paul.
Yeah. Jolly, kind, nice Paul.
Jolly, kind, nice, not cranky Paul.
Well, I know you're getting your Instagram followers up. So guys, you need to follow Julie.
God,
where can our listeners find you?
At Tyler Blackburn. No, I'm kidding. At Julie Plack. I'm super easy. I'm one. My two names is one on Twitter and
perfect.
Instagram.
Oh. Well, guys, we will come back and visit us next week. We are about to pop open a really good bottle of wine.
Yes.
And hang out. But thanks for joining us.
Dear Action Challenge.